Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is the show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit my website, you can ask additional questions, even about past shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. I've launched a new podcast titled Aspects of Spirituality, which is also available on iHeart. Aspects of Spirituality addresses numerous spiritual topics in short weekly podcasts. You're able to request future topics when you go to my website also. Evolution is a slow process that takes many hundreds of thousands and even millions of years to cause significant changes in a species. Archaeologists and anthropologists tell us that hominoid or ape-like beings have been on Earth for several million years. Yet scientists tell us modern man seems to have suddenly appeared on this planet about 250,000 years ago. As such, science has been unsuccessful to date in searching for the missing links to connect us to other hominoids. One would think that this would be easily discovered, as there should be a whole species to find, and probably more than one species. Then science tells us 10 to 12,000 years ago, civilization suddenly occurred all across the planet when farming and the domestication of animals suddenly began. Interestingly, the DNA of the domesticated farm animals like pigs and sheep was somehow altered and is different than their wild cousins. Also, the DNA of the farm crops like wheat, corn, and rice is also different than their wild cousins. How all this could have occurred through the natural evolutionary process is more than unlikely. Statistically, it's virtually impossible. Then if you look at the mammoth stone structures like the pyramids, some of which we couldn't build today, and structures like Baalbek in Lebanon, which used 3 million pound stones shaped so smoothly they appear laser cut, it soon becomes very clear that mankind's ancient history is a complete mystery to science. The explanation of human history presented to us by mainstream science simply makes no sense. However, one of the most interesting writers on this subject that I've ever found is Zechariah Sitchin, author of 14 books, including The Earth Chronicles, which is a 7-book series describing information about the history of mankind. Our show today is titled Mankind's Origin, and our guest is Dr. M.J. Evans, author of Zechariah Sitchin, Extraterrestrial Origins of Humanity. Dr. Evans taught environmental geography at SUNY Empire State College for 30 years. She was a friend and colleague of Zechariah Sitchin for 20 years, and now spends most of the year in Turkey studying ancient sites and landscape. Dr. M.J. Evans also goes by the name of Chris. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Good morning, David. So nice to talk to you.
Hey, it's great to have you here. Let's start out. Can you tell us who Zechariah Sitchin was?
Well, I could sum it up in just a few words. He was a genius who was among us for almost a decade. A century. Okay. He died when he was 90 in 2010.
Okay.
And he published, as you just mentioned, 14 books. He was a consummate researcher. He was a very circumspect and stately-looking man. If you passed him on the street, you probably wouldn't turn around and say, oh, there goes Zechariah Sitchin. He did a lot of public appearances. He traveled with a group of people periodically throughout the 90s and the first decade of the new century. He had an unusual, as compared with the traditional research mindset, he had an unusual mindset because when he taught himself to read the cuneiform tablets that were being found in the Middle East, he asked the question, is it possible that these things that the tablets report for us are really true? He used a contemporary mindset. He did not say, oh, these are really fascinating stories. They must be myth. They must be the imaginations and religious beliefs of the early settlers on this planet, who we refer to as the ancient ones. And what he discovered is that they were dictating what was written on those tablets to a race of beings that we now call humans or earthlings that they created. And they created them because the reason they came to this planet was to mine gold to preserve the atmosphere on their own planet, which needed pulverized gold.
Okay, we need to slow up a little bit.
Okay. All these ideas run together.
I know. Okay, let's go back a little bit. And so Zechariah Sitchin, he was a scholar, a researcher, a man who could speak, who taught himself how to read a number of the ancient languages, certainly to include cuneiform. How about Sanskrit? Could he read Sanskrit?
He was familiar with Sanskrit. I don't know. He never really told me whether he was conversant with it. He recognized that there were people who focused on Sanskrit, which is not an obvious language, so it really takes a lot of intensive intellectual study. No, he focused on Sumerian, Akkadian, Babylonian, ancient Hebrew, and of course he was a Hebrew speaker because he grew up in Palestine, did all of his schooling up until college in Palestine.
Okay. Now, science, archaeologists, I guess, they have found over 40,000 clay tablets, and these tablets are, I guess they can be 2 or 3 inches long and high.
They can fit in the palm of your hand, or they can be as big as one of our oversized books.
Yeah. Okay. So, and they found some 40,000 and over
time. They really found more than that, but that's a good number.
Okay. So they found a lot of these things and they've been finding them for a long time.
Right.
And when did they find the first ones? Do you remember?
Well, it's back in the early 1800s when a lot of museums and universities wanted the explorations of the Middle East started to really unfold. And most of the prestigious institutions sent teams out to get the discoveries. There was quite a bit of competition in those early days because, of course, whatever knowledge would come out of the finds of the material objects would belong to those museums and universities. So, in fact, there was a fair amount of skullduggery that went on.
They broke
into the mound, that sand-covered mound that proved to be the dwelling place of King Ashurbanipal, and they broke in at 2 o'clock in the morning and uncovered in lower levels of the structure thousands of these clay tablets, almost as though you walked into a modern library where there were enormous stacks all filled with books that were cataloged. And that's what they found. They found enormous numbers of these well-organized collections of tablets.
Okay.
And they even found indexes that told who scribed them and what they said in summary.
Now, these tablets are now really spread around the world, and they're in universities and museums. I mean, I know University of Pennsylvania has some, obviously, London. I guess most museums and people that are in these things, they have these things.
Yeah, big collections.
Yeah, exactly, and they are they cuneiform is a language that science has figured out how to translate. And one of the ways they know how to translate these is that if they find one of these, they'll take a picture of it and they'll send it to maybe a half a dozen different organizations that claim that they can translate it. And then they'll look at the translations that come back. And if they're all the same, they'll say, well, you know, we pretty much have this language down. And cuneiform is one of those. So nobody is arguing what the tablets say. They argue that this is where I want you to hop in. Sitchin had a different view of these tablets. The words, everybody agrees what the words on the tablets are. How did he look at these differently?
Well, they were being called myth. And myth, in most of our minds, when we first encounter that word, we think of imagination or stories that have been made up around just little fabric, little bits of evidence. But we don't put much stock in the accuracy, and we certainly don't call myth science. It's not provable. So consequently, his mindset came from the fact that he always called himself a reporter. He was fluent. He taught himself the cuneiform. And by the way, cuneiform is considered by the experts to be the very first language on Earth. We don't know for sure what the language was that was spoken by the ancient ones that are talked about in the cuneiform. We know what the cuneiform stories tell us, and we know that those stories, according to Sitchin's research, were dictated by an ancient race of people who had come to this earth. The date that he uses is 445,000 years ago, and they essentially lived on Earth and developed cities. They built structures in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They lived here. They carried out their daily activities, you might say. Their time frame, by the way, was much different than ours. We measure a day by the revolution of the sun around the Earth. They measured a year, and we then count out 365 days to count a year. Their year is 3,600 years because they come from a planet that comes out of deep space, circles around our sun, and goes back in deep space, and that journey takes 3,600, give or take 100 years either way. But essentially, he recognized that their time frame was much different than ours. So they could accomplish far more in what we call a year. And that, I think, was one of the major contributions that he made. He figured out when they talked about a SAR, S-A-R, they were talking about a journey of the planet from which they came.
Okay. So this information that you're talking about came off of these clay tablets. Is that correct? Or did they come off of other things besides the clay tablets?
Mostly the clay tablets, because it's not a spoken language. It has to be translated into words. And it went through a lot of transliteration and perfection to get it into the English that we can now read if we go on the web and put the title of a collection, like the Enuma Elish, which is a series of seven tablets, and it is, you can read it on the web. And there are many, many other famous stories that can be read now in English only because of the linguistic work of thousands of scholars.
Yeah. The interesting thing, I think, is a lot of the old Bible stories, like Adam and Eve and Noah and such like that, they're written in some of these tablets. Now they have a different interpretation than what maybe have been put in the Bible, but fundamentally it's the same story.
Yes, and that said, that tells us that the Sumerian tablets were the original explanations. And the Bible, in a sense, borrowed and paraphrased and shortened and built logical stories from the Sumerian tablets. That's not often talked about. Many Bible believers assume that the Bible's information was dictated by God. And you can't argue with a person who holds that belief.
Right.
But the other complicating factor is that when the Sumerians became numerous and were taught by these ancient ones to do the work, to become astrologers, to become money changers and record keepers, and they were very intelligent. They were created to be intelligent. And when the tablets came, they were ascribed to be the knowledge of the Sumerians, when in fact the Sumerians were created people. They were created by the ancient ones. In fact, there are tablets that talk about Enki, who was the leader of the first mission to come, and he brought 50 men or 50 beings with him, and they built the ancient civilization. What Sitchin has done is to unravel some of those questions about where did certain things come from? How did they know these things? Well, this knowledge was not created by the Sumerians. Where did it come from? Well, it came from another planet. It came with emissaries, with astronauts who brought it, who lived here for thousands of our years, and who essentially were way ahead of the Sumerians and modern science even. Sitchin raises a question on one of his book covers: is modern science catching up with ancient knowledge? And the answer, of course, is yes, finally.
Yeah. When we say that they created mankind, people will look at that and say that's how could somebody do that? But I guess what they did, at least what the tablets imply that they did, is that they mixed their own DNA, and they looked like us, with the DNA of one of the hominoids that was already here living on the planet.
Right.
And so what they really did is they created a new physical body.
Right.
But they don't create, there's a soul that goes within a body. And that soul is that's not created at birth. The soul is a soul, and it comes
It comes out of the other realm that's beyond the veil.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought it was interesting in one of Sitchin's books, he said that Enki was in front of the council, and there was this council of governors
the leaders of this group of people from the other planet. Yes.
Right. And before he created this group, he made it clear that this new race that he was going to create would be ensouled. In other words, they would have souls, they would be people. And everybody agreed
out of the DNA. That what we now call soul, it is not a material substance. It is an ethereal substance. Right. It's sort of like walking through a cloud, a mist. It's there, but it's not there. When the sun comes out and melts the moisture that's hanging over the mountains that I live in, for example, I think about the soul, because first you see it and then you don't. It didn't just go away. It changed form. And that's what happened when they created Enki. By the way, was motivated by the fact that they needed to mine gold, and the workers got sick and tired of being relegated to these deep, dark, dirty mines where the gold was found, and they mutinied. And
let's go back and talk about, you mentioned Enki. Who's Enki and who's Enlil? And who's Anu?
Okay. Anu is the god, or I'm sorry, that's not a good word, is the king of the planet Nibiru that has a 3,600-year orbit that comes into our solar system on that trajectory of approximately 3,600 years. He's the king of the civilization there. And the history of Anu is interesting in its own right, but we'll not take time this morning to talk about that. He had a firstborn son who was born of a concubine because he lived in a gorgeous palace. He had gardens that were made of precious stones. And he had six concubines, plus a wife. The wife was the official mother of his son, his second-born son, but the one who was entitled to follow in his father's footsteps and take responsibility.
That was Enlil.
That was Enlil. So Enki was the first-born son, but he did not, his birth mother was not correct according to their belief structure. And so consequently, Enki was sent on this, and he was a very accomplished scientist, probably would put any of our major scientists to shame in terms of the scope and context and validity of his scientific knowledge. But we have the evidence of his knowledge in the genetic engineering that he and his sister Ninhursag, who also was born on the planet Nibiru, and we have hit the evidence because he created what they called, and what we call humans, they called Earthlings. They created something called the Adamu, A-D-A-M-U. And the interesting thing about cuneiform language is there are various pictograms, etched pictures that come off of information that was etched on a cylinder, which is like a thumb, only maybe a little fatter. And they were 3 to 4 inches tall, and they etched an entire picture. And when those cylinders were rolled out on wet clay, they created a picture. And Sitchin refers to the pictograms that accompany much of the text. And there is a famous pictogram, and it's in my book, and they were rectangular, obviously. On one side is a female character holding up a small being. And on the other side is a male character with test tubes behind him in the photograph and two entwined snakes at the bottom edge of the clay tablet. The text that goes with this is from the female voice, and it says, "Look what my hands have wrought." She was marveling that she had created a perfect being. And by the way, we look like them. It's look like us. We look like them, and that's important.
Yeah. That's true. So they ended up creating our physical form. And so they did this, and this was Enki, who was the eldest, but not the heir of the throne, and Enlil, and they always had in these stories, they always had a rivalry going, and sometimes this rivalry got fairly out of hand, I would say.
Absolutely. In fact, I devote a whole chapter to the fact that the concept of war that's rampant on our planet today came from that other planet and came through the entities of these two heirs, Enki, the firstborn, and Enlil, his brother. What happened in the mining operation is that the miners stopped working, and that stopped the gold supply, and the king, Anu, said, "We can't abide that. You are not forgiven your mission on that planet. You must continue to send us gold, pulverized gold, because we have an environmental emergency on our planet. Our heat source is evaporating. We need pulverized gold in the atmosphere to preserve our habitat." Interesting that the environmental problems existed over 500,000 years ago on another planet, and we're now revisiting those challenges. Anyway, when that happened, the king said, "All right, I'm coming down to the planet, and I will convene a council of the leadership." And he also brought his second-born son, who, the minute he put his foot on Earth, became the heir of Earth as well as Nibiru. Now, Enki had been here for many thousands of years and had done marvelous things, including creating all kinds of structures. He changed the route of the Tigris-Euphrates River to create a canal that could be dredged. He went far and wide, producing all kinds of structures, which we now have. We can probably attribute, if we would let go of the history which has occluded our ability to think out of the box, we could probably say that not only the pyramids in Egypt, but also the ancient structures of Stonehenge and Avebury and Baalbek and all of the ancient structures that we don't seem to be able to understand how they were built. And if you accept Sitchin's explanation, you can't help but come to the conclusion they were built by these first settlers to Earth many, many hundreds of thousands of years ago. So they had capabilities, they had engineering, they had perhaps the ability to put energy in stones that made stones plastic and therefore could be moved, not like we have to move them physically, lifting them up or shaping them. In South America, some of the things that they constructed have such precise edges that you can't even fit a razor blade between them. And scientists and explorers have been working for centuries trying to figure out how they built these things. Anyway, the whole business of the mutiny caused Anu to come to Earth. And the minute he did, he brought Enlil, his second-born son, who obviously became a leader. Enki, at that point, had a horrendous temper tantrum with his father, according to the tablet stories. And
he thought this planet was his.
He thought it was his. And the minute his brother put his foot on planet Earth, he lost it. And he literally lost his temper at the council. But then when it became obvious that the gold supply had to continue, he says to the council and his father, the king, I have a solution. There is a hominid walking around on this earth, and if I take the genes of one of our species and blend it with that hominid, who is, by the way, like us, but not developed, not civilized, not intelligent, doesn't follow orders, behaves like an animal. He then went to work, and it probably took hundreds of years for he and his sister to come up with that perfect being that is immortalized on that tablet. Look what my hands have wrought. They probably worked many, many, many varieties. There are stories that do tell us that there were many, many miscreations. Sitchin doesn't deal with that. He alludes to it, but he doesn't deal with that. So therefore, my book doesn't allude to it. But if you've heard of other, for example, the head of a man, head and shoulders of a man, and the body of a horse that comes out of Greek mythology, that's what we're alluding to. We can't say for sure, but it makes sense in the context of the Sumerian tablet material.
And this race was lived a long time. They had figured out how to deal with. They were not eternal. They didn't live forever, but
no,
they lived for maybe a half a million years or something like that.
Right. And Sitchin includes King List in a couple of his books that are in the thousands of years that a particular king would have reigned. And we can't, when people encounter Sitchin, the first thought that comes into their mind is, oh my God, this can't be true. I've never heard of this. And then they look back through, if they're ambitious, they look back through the thousands of volumes of modern research reports, they read books, and they still don't come up with answers. And one of the most monumental outcomes of Sitchin's work is that he provides us with answers as to what the sources were. There was no literature before Sitchin started to write his books. Nowadays, there are some people who are saying, oh no, he's writing science fiction, he's not, he can't be, you know, there's no word for this or that in any of the literature, the dictionaries or whatever. That can't be true, because most of these people that are mouthing these criticisms against Sitchin either have not read all of his or are so stuck in the knowledge that they acquired that they cannot think out of the box like Sitchin did.
Yeah. Now, Chris, the interesting thing I find is that, you know, people might argue and they'd say, well, you know, why don't we know about this? But if you look back, and we've all been exposed to what we were taught in school to be the myths of the Greeks and the Romans and the Indian gods, if you will, gods with a little g, mind you, not a big G. But you know, if you go back into the history of virtually every society on the planet, and whether you're out in Oceania or wherever you are, every one of them has a memory of in their ancient history of gods that walked with them. This is common, which I found interesting, across all of mankind's ancient history memories. They were oral memories, and they were called myths when they were passed down, but that's really what they were. It's every society. If you go back, the Indians of America, and the stories are the same. The story of Noah.
Absolutely.
It's all over the place. So,
and by the way, the Noah story is about 30,000 years. Actually, the flood happened, according to Sitchin, about 11,000 years. But the story has its history, and again, when you say history, you think of published or written material that can be read, studied, thought about, published in different interpretations. That's not what we don't have access to that, and that's what Sitchin's contribution is. He shines a light on, as you talk about, those traditions, those existences of beings who created and behaved on Earth. And now there are, as you point out, remnant populations, the Aborigines of Australia, the Native Americans of North America and Asia, all these civilizations. And there was a very developed civilization in the Indus Valley. Actually, that was given to a granddaughter of the king of the other planet, Anu, and her name was Ishtar, and she was given, when the brothers started to fight over who ruled what, the king decided that he would have a lottery. He would draw straws, and he would give portions of earth to each of his progeny so that they would stop fighting. And Enki got Africa, Enlil got everything north of the Mediterranean and Indian Ocean, Ishtar got the Indus Valley. The sister of those two brothers got the Sinai Peninsula. So in other words, the king decided that if he assigned territories to each of his progeny, that he could stop their internecine warfare. Well, it worked for a short while. And then other things began to happen. Their progeny began to believe that they had rights entitled to them by their fathers, and they began to war. Sitchin talks about something called the First Pyramid War and the Second Pyramid War, and these were essentially wars between the different regions of Earth that were ruled by different Nephilim.
Yeah. Now, you know, Sitchin wrote a whole book in regards to Yahweh. And Yahweh is the Old Testament God of the Jewish and Christian in beliefs. He was convinced that Yahweh was one of the of this race of people, whether Anunnaki. Nobody knows exactly who he was, but he tried to figure out which one of these gods with a little G he was. And he didn't come up with a conclusion.
He doesn't come to a conclusion. If you read that book called Divine Encounters, he does not come to a conclusion. It's as though he's alluding, and this is now my interpretation, he's alluding to the all-seeing, all-knowing, all-pervasive God of the universe, which probably the word God, which implies human, or structural flesh and blood. I believe
he later learned the shark's mouth was 26
ethereal
inches wide
force
the
of the universe. When they first
deep.
Announced within the last few years the identification of dark matter, the thought that entered my head was, of course, this is love. This is the force that pervades the entire universe and well beyond our galaxy. It is the matter that permeates everything. And I think I may be way out on a limb at this point, but I think we will discover that, yes, there are substances. We call them stars because that's all the light we can see from them. But I think that we will discover that the all-pervasive forces of the universe may be the source of the soul of human beings, is that force that is called by the science arena dark matter. It is not a material substance. It is not electrons, protons, nuclei. It is something different. And I don't think we have any concept of what it is. And so we're going to give it all kinds of other names in our process of learning and exploring and figuring out what it could be.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know about that. You know, we have an interesting history, and one of the things in your book that you talked about, which was a fascinating story about Chernobyl's nuclear accident.
Yes.
Do you remember the details of that? Vladimir Rubstov,
yes,
who was a Russian scientist, he had an interesting discussion about the air traffic controllers and such over in Chernobyl. Why don't you relate that story? It kind of blew me away when you reported it.
The aeronautic superintendent, you might call them, observed over Chernobyl.
This is the Russian aeronautical group.
Right. They observed over the Chernobyl before the fire broke out. They observed a spaceship, and they took radiological readings, and they found that they were 8,000 whatever, Rankins per hour or whatever. And then the fire broke out, and the nuclear wind began to churn up and start to devastate, as it did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And by the way, well, we'll get back to that another time. That wind is characterized in a story that Zachariah put on the web, and I put it at the end of my book called The Evil Wind. But anyway, they were observing from Kharkov, which is a city near, but not that near, not near enough to get originally contaminated by the nuclear blast. But essentially, they saw this spaceship, which they identified as brass colored, and they saw it send down some beams to the fire.
This is right over Chernobyl, and it's about 300-400 yards above the tower that was burning.
And when they did, the explosion didn't completely go away, but it was reduced.
The radiation.
after they got the ability to recognize that it was, well, parenthetically, under control, they took another reading and it was 800, not 8,000. And I consider that, and that, first of all, that spaceship was manned by Anunnaki, and I'd have no proof for that other than to say that it was a palliative activity to save the region, to save human beings from what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where we didn't have that kind of action on the part of space, a space-based group.
There okay,
had to be,
now.
There had to be a group.
Okay. So here is an incident that supposedly has happened, and it was reported by one of the Russian scientists back
yes,
in.
Yes, and they gave a presentation at MUFON, which is the Mutual UFO Network in Eastern Europe, and that's how it got published on the web. This
okay,
was reported
now,
by the scientists.
Okay, so now. We look at our history and we look around us and we don't see any of these Anunnaki and so they must have left. When does Sitchin know when they left?
Well, in his last couple of books, he talks about the Nazca lines, and he indicates that those were made when they left the planet. Where there's no way to know for sure if they all left. There are people now, scientists, finding these 12, 14-foot skeletons. There are some, maybe the giant of the Bible that Samson killed. Maybe that was a remnant Anunnaki. We don't really know. Science has a lot of work to do to get more information. But if they were working from the base of knowledge of Sitchin, they would probably make better progress. Again, that's my conclusion. Because I think, as you point out, there is evidence in many, many civilizations of beings from another planet. And it's only in yours and my lifetime that concept even has enough validity for us to say, of course I believe that we are not alone in the universe, that there are civilizations out there that we haven't found yet. But here's another conclusion that I've come to. When we get reports that there are 15 or 20 other civilizations viewing Earth, and that there are some beings that have come to live on Earth that are hybrids, we have to really stop and think. If we just say, oh, no, that can't be, if we just discount it because it seems too fantastic, we're closing the box. We are not allowing observation, information to be drawn from these many, many, many pools of sort of imperfect understandings. And we're not allowing ourselves to think like Sitchin did, which was to say, what if it is true? And he was known for saying, let's not close the door. Let's keep an open mind. Let's consider possibilities. Now, he didn't use those kinds of words, but
that's what you draw. That would be the conclusion you would draw from reading his books.
Absolutely. You have to say, wait a minute. This man was not constrained by the known history, which creates a kind of box with a lid on it. He considered possibilities. And then with that optimistic, open-minded approach, he went to the many, many literatures that you mentioned. He had studied most of those other stories, histories, partial explanations, and saw commonalities. And that is the ingredients that informed the books that he wrote. I start.
So Sitchin would say, I guess, if he was still alive today, that the humanity may have left humanity alone, pretty much. But they haven't necessarily left completely. They may still be monitoring us, and if this description about Chernobyl is true, and I have no reason to believe that it isn't, then they're helping us. And maybe
I believe they still are helping us. And
yeah. And why do you think they left?
I think they left because they realized that they had created an earth full of people who had the capability, and special ones among them could hold the responsibilities of kingship, and they bequeathed their power to these beings. And that's where our history begins.
Do you think that they felt that they were causing more trouble than, for mankind, and they, because of all their fighting, and then they thought, well, somebody made a decision. Maybe Andrew made a decision. He says, enough is enough. We got to leave them alone.
That's a very interesting conclusion, and it is entirely possible.
Yeah. What do you think?
All we know is that they left, and they left evidence, and they left the tablets. They left humanity with its intelligence and its curiosity. They left us this marvelous legacy. My first book is called The Legacy of Zachariah Sitchin. I tried to just to put a more academic spread on it, because I was still working when I published that. I tried to bring in the model that future science opens up for us, that you consider four things: possible, probable, preferable, and plausible futures. And there are questions that come with each of those words that open vistas that can be explored. Of course, the one thing that I think have brought them back, at least to our skies, if not to our physical planet, is nuclear energy. Just about everything that has happened, including Chernobyl, including the latest Japanese problem with their reactor, have had UFO observations over them. The UFO history of sightings is now increasing almost 100-fold every year. There is a whole directory, MUFON has a whole directory online of sightings, and they are occurring by the hundreds every day.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's more likely that UFOs are here than it is that they're not here.
They're here with intelligent beings. Now, whether they are robots that are doing this far distant explorations, or whether they are a race of other intelligent, whether there are multiple races of intelligent, scientifically aware, and we have no way of conceptualizing what might be out there, because we don't have any evidence. We don't have a history. History is the basis upon which we draw our conclusions about what happens. That's how we look into any phenomena that seems to be unusual or unheard of.
At least we don't have official evidence in the public domain.
Well, and there's more in science, but how many of us read the official scientific journals in any field? And this is what academia is all about. But the problem is academia is under a shroud that says if it hasn't been published, it doesn't exist. You can't go out and create a new platform. And
Chris, we're running out of time. We can't keep going on this. But let me give you one more question, and then we're gonna bail on this thing.
Okay.
What do you think of the those Caltech astronomers that think
radio?
That they identified a planet? A large distant planet in our solar system.
It's coming into our solar system. If you read the Enuma Elish, even though it's in the vernacular of cuneiform, you will see that the planet Nibiru, and Sitchin has a lot of information that says it returns to Earth's vicinity, circles around our sun, and goes back out to deep space every 3,600 years, which means that it's on its own trajectory. And what the scientists are now talking about, and by the way, the observations in the southern hemisphere are far more prominent because the orbit of Nibiru is coming on an orbit that will enter our ecliptic, which is the path of our planets, 30 degrees below the ecliptic. And so the observations in Australia and Chile and Southern Hemisphere that's where the sources of this information is, that there's a big planet coming our way. If this is true, and you can look back at history and Earth history and see that there have been calamities, there have been terrible disruptions of Earth, meaning the planetary plates that structure the planet itself, where the oceans are, where they will go, that there have been numerous tsunamis, you can only conclude that if what they're observing is the planet Nibiru and it's going to insert between Jupiter and Mars and zoom around our sun and continue back out into deep space, that we're in for one hell of a ride.
Yeah. Now it's not going to be here for hundreds and hundreds of years.
I would argue with you.
Okay. You think it's coming quicker. Chris, we've run out of time.
I realize that. And we've got so much more to talk about, Dave.
Right. So thank you so much for being on the show. You can find Chris. Chris, what's your website? The people can find you.
I don't have a website. I just have email, and they're welcome to send me emails.
Okay.
But 1933@gmail.com.
Okay. But they can find your book on Amazon, Zachariah Sitchin, Extraterrestrial Origins of Humanity. And what's your other book?
It's called The Legacy of Zachariah Sitchin. It was published in 2011, and it has different information. It obviously has similar themes, but it goes into much more scientific detail about the psychological, for example, reaction that people have to his information.
Okay.
We got to
stop, Chris.
Okay.
Hey, thanks so much for being on the show.
David, thanks for inviting me. I have enjoyed every minute of it.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and past shows are posted on my website at davidgagan.com. If you want to investigate spirituality in more detail, I cover many spiritual subjects in my book, The Endless Journey. Also, please join me on iHeartRadio at Aspects of Spirituality. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You're a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.